Huck. Joni's parents, Jeff and Julie, they are a self-proclaimed J family, pull into the driveway at 6 o'clock on the dot. Huck somehow managed to get everyone out of the house except for Ayers. She is sitting at the counter, wringing her hands, and staring at a bottle of 18-year-old Flor de Caña rum like she's drowning and it's a life raft. Huck nearly suggests they both do a shot to fortify their nerves, but then he thinks better of it. As his grandfather used to say, hard things are hard. Huck has done plenty of hard things in his life. He was drafted into the Vietnam War right out of high school. He had been born and raised on Isla Mirada in the Florida Keys, so he thought the U.S. Navy would be a natural fit, and he was happy because in the Navy, you didn't get shot at. But choice was for those who enlisted, not for those who got drafted, and the powers that be placed Huck in the Marine Corps. His first year in Vietnam was spent face down in the mud, in the jungle, in the rice paddies, fearing for his life every second of every day, developing an addiction to nicotine that he still couldn't shake. Later, years after he got home, he had to put his then-wife, Kimberly, into rehab for drinking and serve her with divorce papers. He buried his sister, Caroline, who died of brain cancer at 41, and his mother, who died of heartbreak over Caroline, and eventually his beloved father, the original captain, Captain Paul Powers, who had run a fishing charter out of Isla Mirada for 50 years. He had taken out the likes of Jack Nicklaus and Frank Sinatra, and who had taught Huck everything he knew about fishing and about being a man. It was after his father died that Huck moved to the Virgin Islands, where life was easy for a long time. Huck bought his boat, started his business, met and married Leanne Small, an island treasure. Huck would name burying Leanne as the hardest thing he'd ever had to do, but only because he had loved the woman so damn much. This would be harder. Maya comes bounding into the house, her skin burnished from a full day outside, even though Jeff and Julie are fastidious about sunscreen and bug spray. The smile on her face is proof that he was right. She had a happy day. Maybe the last happy day for the rest of her childhood. He doesn't want to tell her. Maya sees Ayers and goes right to her for a hug. Huck catches Ayers' expression over Maya's shoulder. Her eyes are shining. He doesn't have but a few seconds left before Ayers breaks down. They should have done the rum shot. He's shaking. Maya, he says, please sit. She pulls away from Ayers and looks at him wide-eyed. Are you mad? She asks. You said I could go. I'm not mad, Huck says. But would you please sit down? Ayers and I have to tell you something. What? Maya says. She is standing, defiant now in her posture. Ayers reaches out to take Maya's hand. There was a helicopter crash north of Virgin Gorda, Huck says. Maya, your mother is dead. There is a blankness on Maya's face, and this, Huck thinks, is the soul-destroying moment. Maya taking in the words and making sense of them. Then, Maya starts to scream. The sound is raw, primitive. It's the sound of an animal. Ayers pulls Maya close, and tears stream down Huck's face, and he thinks, hard things are hard, and please, God, do not give him anything harder than this. The screaming morphs into crying, great ragged sobs, seemingly bigger than the girl herself. Huck goes for tissues, a glass of ice water, a pillow in case she wants to punch something. He and Ayers had made a pact that they would not shush Maya or tell her everything was going to be okay. They were not going to lie to the girl. They were going to let her do her thing, and then they were going to answer her questions as honestly as they could. The crying ends eventually. Ayers leads Maya to the sofa, and Huck plants himself in the chair, within arm's reach. He had been over at Schneider Hospital with Leanne when Rosie gave birth to Maya. He had been the third person to hold her, red and wriggling and utterly captivating. If Huck were very honest, he would admit to feeling a quick stab of disappointment that the baby hadn't been a boy. Huck had imagined a grandson to take fishing. But Maya stole Huck's heart that first moment in his arms, and he decided that she would make a better mate anyway. The men in Leanne's family were either weak or absent. It was the women who were strong. Maya blows her nose, gets a clear breath. Her face, which had been so radiant when she walked in, is now mottled, and if Huck isn't imagining it, her dainty features have instantly aged. She suddenly looks 17 or 25. "Helicopter," Maya says. "So she was with my father. Is he dead too?" "Father?" Ayers says. "Honey," Huck says, "she was with her friend, the one who comes to visit." The man's name is Russell Steele. Rosie told Huck the guy's name when he first came on the scene, a few months after Leanne died, but Rosie kept the relationship private. The fellow showed up 1 or 2 weeks a month, November through May. He had some big villa on the North Shore. Huck had a pretty good idea which road it was, though he'd never been invited to the house and he'd never met the guy. Maya, he knew, went to the house when the man was on island some of the time, though there were plenty of occasions when Rosie had asked Huck to cover so that she and her mystery lover could have some privacy. Huck won't lie. The arrangement had been troublesome to him. He had expected at least an introduction. He had expected, if not a weekly barbecue, then an invitation for a beer. But Rosie had been both stubborn and contrite when it came to the invisible man. She was very sorry, and Huck could see on her face that the emotion was genuine, but she wanted to keep her relationship private. The island was small. She had been born and raised there. Everyone had always been right up in her business, and she just wanted one thing that would not be discussed and dissected by the community at large. Huck had suspected this was not how Rosie truly felt. He had suspected that her plea was on behalf of the invisible man. Which meant, of course, only one thing. He was married. Or he was one of those bastards who had a girl like Rosie in every port. International finance was his business, Rosie said, which meant, of course, only one thing. He was also a criminal. You want an honest business? Go out on a boat, catch a fish, and eat it for dinner. But the invisible man should not be confused with the pirate, which is what Maya is now doing. The pirate was some other white fella who came in on his buddy's yacht, hot on Rosie. This was back when Rosie was cocktail waitressing at Keneal Bay, knocked her up, and left without a trace. Rosie called him the pirate because he'd stolen her heart. "And her dignity," Leanne had said privately to Huck. Rosie had fallen hard for the pirate in the 4 days they'd spent together. It had been over a long weekend, President's Day in February. And then Maya had been born on November 15th.
"If by friend you mean Russ, then yes, he's my father. Was my father. Russell Steele. So they're both dead?"
Maya holds Huck's gaze.
"They're both dead?"
"Yes," Huck says.
He wonders if there's something he doesn't know. He wonders if Rosie let the invisible man adopt Maya at some point over the years without telling anyone. Without telling him. He knows the invisible man pays for Maya's expenses, including her tuition at Gift Hill, but Huck had thought that was a gesture, possibly even a payment in exchange for Rosie's discretion. Rosie still had a job, paid her own bills, lived under Huck's roof whenever the invisible man was away, which was a lot. Had Rosie been hiding something that big?
How had she pulled it off, legally, without someone in the courthouse, in Charlotte Amali, blabbing his mouth, and it eventually getting back to Huck? Impossible, Huck thinks. They must have just started calling this steel fellow Maya's father.
So, I'm an orphan, Maya says. I have no one.
You have me, Ayer says. You're always going to have me. And you have me, Huck says. He gets down on his knees before Maya, which seems fitting because he has done nothing for the past 12 years so much as worship this child. He knows she's too young to understand the quality of his devotion, and this is probably for the best. She doesn't need someone to worship her. She needs someone to love her, clothe her, feed her, teach her right from wrong, someone to set limits and provide opportunities, someone to believe in her and be her champion. And that person will be Huck. He will be her unconditional. He will be her no matter what. Baker. Anna did Baker a favor before he left. She filled a prescription of Ativan for his mother.
I bet you she won't take them, Anna said, but it'll be good to have them just in case.
It turned out Anna knew Irene better than Baker imagined. She did refuse the pills at first. But Thursday night, when the sun is dropping like a hot coal into the Caribbean and Irene has refused Baker's offer of dinner three times, she says,
I think I'd like to try sleeping. Can I see those pills?
Do you want the master bedroom, Mom? Cash asked.
Heavens no, Irene said. I'll take one of the guest rooms upstairs.
She offered them both a weak smile.
That's what I am, a guest. A guest in your father's house.
Cash helped Irene get situated upstairs while Baker checked the contents of the kitchen. Paulette had said it was well stocked, and she also said that she could arrange for a private chef if they so desired.
No private chef, Baker said. I don't think my mother wants any strangers in the house.
The landscapers are scheduled every Friday, Paulette said.
Please, Baker said. If you would just tell everyone to give us our privacy for a week.
Of course, Paulette said. Call if you need anything.
Now Baker inspects the fridge and cabinets. Well stocked is an understatement. The fridge is filled with steaks, hamburgers, pasta salad, deli meats, fresh vegetables, milk, eggs, and a giant bowl of tropical fruit salad. The bottom shelf holds four flavors of local beer. The cabinets contain enough pasta, cereal, and canned goods to survive a nuclear fallout, including, curiously, six cans of SpaghettiOs. The SpaghettiOs remind Baker of Floyd, and he thinks to go out on the deck and call home, but honestly, the only positive thing about this whole surreal trip is that he's able to leave his own problems behind. Or, rather, his own problems become what is happening here. His father is dead, right? Baker hasn't been able to feel the reality of Russ's death, however, because nothing about this makes any sense. Take, for example, the wine cellar. Russell Steele was a man who liked his Leinenkugels, his Bud Light, and his scotch. Baker has no memory of Russ ever drinking wine. Champagne, maybe, at Baker and Anna's wedding. One sip. The person who liked wine in their family was Irene. She drank Chardonnay from California. Her everyday wine was Kendall Jackson, her favorite splurges, Seamy and cake bread. Curiously, or not, Baker had found one case of both Seamy and cake bread in his father's wine cellar, almost as if he were expecting Irene to visit. Cash comes down the stairs just as Baker is cracking open what he believes to be a well-deserved beer, and he reaches into the fridge to grab one for Cash. Cash takes it from him and nods toward the pool.
She's asleep, Cash says. The pill knocked her right out. Which is a good thing because I need to talk to you.
They go out to the swimming pool and sit with their feet in the shallow end. The gurgle of the fountain will drown their voices in case Irene should appear.
What is it? Baker says.
He had a mistress, Cash says. A West Indian woman. I found a picture of the two of them in the master bedroom. Baker takes a sip of his beer, mango pale ale. It's good, but not quite good enough to distract him from this crushing news about his father. Is nobody as they seem? Does everyone have nefarious secrets? Okay, obviously something was going on with his father, and it occurred to Baker that the local woman in the helicopter was, perhaps, a damning detail. But that was only a maybe. She could have been the pilot's girlfriend, or a tour guide, or one of Russ's clients.
Let me see this picture, Baker says.
Cash disappears into the house, then returns with a framed photograph of Russ and a truly stunning West Indian woman, lying together in a hammock. There is no misreading this photo. What strikes Baker is how Russ looks. He's wearing sunglasses, so it's a bit hard to tell, but the father Baker knows, the goofy Midwestern salesman always ready with a quip or pun, has been replaced by a man who looks sophisticated, worldly, and most of all, confident. When Baker and Cash were growing up, Russ had been like nothing so much as a big, eager Saint Bernard who faced each day with the same quest for attention, love, reassurance. He had a list of DIY projects that he liked to tackle on the weekends. He would go in to wake the boys up on a Saturday morning, calling Baker Buddy and Cash Pal, as he did their entire lives, but they wouldn't stir. Russ would then take a seat at Baker's desk and wait. When the boys finally woke up, he would jump up with a childlike enthusiasm. Baker understood his father's eager to please, don't rock the boat attitude to be the result of his childhood. He had moved every 18 months, and the quest to be found likable and be included was constant. But Baker won't lie. Both he and Cash found their father's obsequiousness off-putting, nearly cringeworthy. There were a lot of shared eye rolls. Once Russ got his new job, he had a new luster, certainly. There was suddenly a ton of money. But Russ's attention was still so intense, possibly even more intense because he was around less frequently, that sometimes Baker and Cash wanted to deflect it. They thought their father was a nice enough guy, but ultimately, they preferred the cooler, more reserved presence of their mother. This man in the photograph, with the open-collared tomato red shirt and the I've got the world by the balls smile, is a stranger. Has Mom seen this? Baker asks.
No.
Good. Cash stands up. I'm returning it to its hiding place.
Get two more beers, Baker says.
Please. Baker grills up 6 cheeseburgers, and he and Cash fall on the food as they used to when they were teenagers, without thinking, without conversation. Then they sit with their empty plates before them, staring at the twinkling lights of Tortola in the distance, and Baker wonders if he should tell Cash about Anna. Cash is, after all, his brother, though they aren't close. They don't confide things. Baker has long viewed Cash as a little punk. That was definitely true through growing up, because Russ and Irene coddled him. And he had spent his adult years freewheeling, which always seemed more like freeloading. Sleeping on his buddy's couches out in Breckenridge, teaching skiing for a pittance because the job came with a free season's pass, living off the food that his roommates who worked at restaurants brought home. Baker and his parents had been unimpressed. But then what did Russ go and do? He bought Cash a business, handed him the keys to 2 outdoor supply stores. Baker had really kept his distance then, because the demonstration of blatant favoritism was so egregious. Baker had always been able to speak frankly with his father, and he nearly told Russ that sinking 200 grand into any business Cash was going to run was as good as sending it to a Nigerian prince. The only time in recent history that Baker had seen Cash in a more favorable light was when Baker had taken Anna to Breckenridge to ski, back when they were dating. Anna had been uncharacteristically effusive in her praise of Cash. She loved that he got them access to the back of the mountain trails. She loved that he was dating the hostess at the hottest sushi restaurant in town and then scored them a table in the window at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. "Your brother knows everyone," Anna had said. "He's like the mayor." 6 months later, Baker had begrudgingly asked Cash to serve as best man in his wedding.
"I really wish we had some weed," Baker says now. "I need to relax. My heart has been racing since Mom called with the news. Maybe I should take one of Mom's Ativans."
Cash takes an audible breath, as though Baker has startled him out of a waking sleep state. "Wait," Cash says. "There's more to the story about the woman Dad was seeing."
"Right," Baker says.
He'd drunk so many beers so quickly on an empty stomach that he'd dropped the thread of their earlier conversation. The woman in the photograph.
"I asked Paulette about her," Cash says. "The woman's name was Rosie Small. There's a memorial service being held tomorrow at the Episcopal Church, followed by a reception at a place called Chester's Getaway."
Baker nods. Todd Croft arranged for Russ's body to be cremated. As for a funeral service, Irene wants to wait until they figure out what's going on before they even tell anyone that Russ is dead. They can't very well tell everyone they know that Russ was killed in a helicopter crash in the Virgin Islands when they have no answers to the inevitable follow-up questions. Baker has scoured the internet. There has been no mention anywhere of a helicopter crash in the Virgin Islands. Baker notices Cash looking at him expectantly.
"What?"
"We have to go tomorrow," Cash says, "to either the service or the reception."
"Why?" Baker says.
"To find out who this woman was," Cash says.
"I'm not sure that's a good idea," Baker says. "What would that accomplish?"
"There are so many questions," Cash says. "How did Dad meet her? How long have they been together?"
"Who cares?" Baker says. "Think about it.
What is it going to benefit you or me to know the answers? She was a woman Dad was screwing down here. How will it help to know any more?" Baker leans in and lowers his voice. "How will it help Mom?" "The answer is, it won't. We need to get Dad's ashes and leave. Put this house on the market, if it's even ours to sell."
"Paulette said it was ours," Cash says. "I'll ask her to produce the deed. Mom will have to call her attorney and have him check Dad's will. If Dad owns this house outright, and the will leaves everything to Mom and the two of us, then it would be ours to sell."
"You sound like Jackass P. Esquire," Baker says. "We need to find Todd Croft. See what he can tell us about Dad's business. It wasn't just a boutique investment firm, Baker."
"No," Baker thinks.
This became evident the second they pulled into the driveway of this house. This is a $12 or $15 million property. If Russ does own it outright, then he was into something far bigger than he claimed to be. Shell companies, offshore accounts, hiding money, cleaning it, the things you see in movies. He had access to a helicopter.
"I really think we should leave things be," Baker says.
"I don't," Cash says. "I'm going to either the service or the reception tomorrow, and you're coming with me. I'll let you pick which one."
"Reception," Baker says. "Obviously, because there will be alcohol."
"People will be more likely to tell us things," Cash says.
"Things we don't want to know," Baker thinks.
At 1 o'clock the next afternoon, They find themselves in one of the two gunmetal gray Jeep Saharas that belong to their father, driving to a place called Chester's Getaway off the Centerline Road. They told their mother they were going on a top-secret investigative mission.
"We can't tell you anything else," Baker said.
"I don't want to know anything else," Irene said. "Do what you have to do. I have my own list."
Baker thought his mother looked marginally better. She had finally slept for a full 12 hours, and then she'd eaten a few chunks of fresh pineapple and a bite of toast.
"What's on your list?" Baker asked.
Irene blinked. "I'm going to call Ed Sorley, our attorney, and ask him to fax me a copy of your father's will. I'm going to call Todd Croft, and I'm going to call Paulette. I was in no shape yesterday to ask her any questions, but today I want to appeal to her woman to woman."
Baker had kissed his mother on the forehead. She was a strong woman. She should be falling apart, but instead, she had made a list.
"Call if you need us," Baker said.
There are cars lined up for hundreds of yards before they reach the entrance to Chester's, and so they have to turn around, double back, and park at the end of the line. They arrive at Chester's at the same time that a bus lets off a load of people, a mix of young and old, white and West Indian, most of them somberly dressed. Chester's is a two-story clapboard building set off the road and painted ivory and dusty pink. The parking lot has been taken over by a tent. Billowing out behind the tent are clouds of barbecue-scented smoke. Somewhere, a steel band is playing.
"It's good that it's crowded," Cash says. "We won't stick out." "Let's get a drink," Baker says.
It feels wrong to be here. They didn't know Rosie Small. They are the sons of her lover, the man who was taking her to Anagata, and who was indirectly responsible for her death. Surely there are people in attendance, possibly a lot of people, who believe Rosie's death is Russ's fault. The place is too packed for there to be any kind of receiving line, thank God, which was another reason for avoiding the service. Cash seems to think everyone here is just going to offer up all kinds of information, but Baker isn't so sure. Baker asks a gentleman in a fedora hat where the bar can be found, and the gentleman says, "Drinks inside, but you got to pay. Food outside is free. Pig roast and all the sides, including Chester's Johnny Cakes. You ever had Chester's Johnny Cakes?" Baker sidles away without answering.
"The bar is inside," he says to Cash.
"It's hot," Cash says. He's pink in the face and sweating. He chose to wear a long-sleeved plaid shirt and a pair of jeans. Baker is in khaki shorts and a navy polo. They both look, well, the word Baker wants to use is white. He doesn't mean Caucasian exactly, but rather pale and out of place, like they've just parachuted in from the North Pole. Only half the people here are West Indian, but the other white people here look tan, weathered, well-seasoned. The inside of Chester's is mercifully cooler, and Baker immediately feels better because the bar is the kind Baker would seek out if he had time to seek out bars. There's a long counter, a few tables, a sticky concrete floor, and a room through the back that has a pool table and a dartboard. Chester's Getaway has clearly seen dramas more interesting than the one he and Cash are presently living, or at least Baker would like to believe this. Two TVs hang over the bar, but they're both shut off. The line for a drink is three deep, and Baker decides to exercise his privilege as older brother.
"You wait," he tells Cash. "I'm going to wander."
"Wander where?" Cash says. "There isn't room to think in here, much less wander."
"Over there," Baker says.
He nods vaguely in the direction of an easel displaying photos. "Celebrating Rosie," it says in bubble letters across the top. Baker hands Cash a 20, since his brother is perpetually low on money.
"And get me two beers, please, when it's your turn."
Cash shrugs and tries to shoulder his way closer to the bar. Meanwhile, Baker shuffles over to the sign and the photos, wondering if there are any photos of Rosie Small with their father. There's a woman standing next to the easel behind a small table where she's encouraging people to sign the guest book.
"Hello," she says to Baker. "Would you like to sign the guest book?"
Baker's mouth falls open. It's not just that he's unsure of what to say. No, the answer to her question is definitely no. He does not want to sign the guest book. It's that she is the prettiest woman he has ever seen. Ever. She has blonde ringlet curls and a smile like the sun. She's a natural beauty, and above and beyond that, she looks nice. Anna is striking, certainly. There have been times in the past 8 years when Baker hasn't been able to stop staring at her. But this woman affects Baker differently. She's lightly tanned with freckles across her nose. She wears no makeup. She has blue eyes and straight white teeth. She wears 5 or 6 silver bracelets and a simple black jersey dress that clings to her slender frame. Looking at her fills Baker with wordless joy. She looks like hope. "I'm in love with you," he thinks, "whoever you are."
"Sure," he says. "I'd love to sign the guest book."
He accepts the pen from her, wondering what name he can possibly sign. He stalls by locking eyes with her and saying,
"Can I get you a drink or anything? You seem to have pulled the short straw, being stuck back here in the corner."
"Oh," she says, "it's fine. Chester is keeping me in rum punches."
She holds up a plastic cup containing an inch of watery pink liquid, a maraschino cherry, and an orange slice.
"He'll be back soon, I'm sure."
She sets down the cup and offers a hand.
"I'm Ayers Wilson, by the way. I was Rosie's best friend."
She tilts her head.
"I don't think I recognize you. How did you know Rosie?"
I didn't, really," Baker says. "I came with someone who knew her. My brother. He's at the bar getting me a beer, I hope."
Ayers laughs.
"Nice brother," she says. "How did he know Rosie?"
Baker says, "he worked with her."
Ayers' eyes widen.
"Really?" she says. "Who's your brother? Is it Skip?" "Oh my God, that's right, Skip's brother from L.A., right? But wait, she's transitioning to a woman. That's not you, I take it."
"No," Baker says.
Just like that, he's been caught.
"Actually, my brother is at the bar, but he didn't work with Rosie."
Ayers shakes her head.
"Don't tell me," she says.
"You guys are crashing, right?"
Baker sighs. "Kind of."
"Here on vacation, saw the crowd, smelled the pig roast, and figured, why not?"
Ayers gives him a pointed look, and he feels like a jackass. Before he can decide if he should tell her who he really is, she shrugs.
"I honestly don't blame you."
"You don't?" Baker says. "I didn't want to come. My brother insisted."
"I'm actually happy to meet a complete stranger who has nothing to do with all of this," Ayers says. "Half the women here are pissed that I'm doing the guest book instead of Rosie's third cousin or Maya's preschool teacher. And as if that's not bad enough, over there in the doorway are my ex-boyfriend and the tramp he left me for."
Baker looks toward the doorway and sees a chunky guy with a buzz cut and a woman in her 20s who has seen fit to come to a memorial reception without either washing her hair or wearing a bra. He turns back to Ayers. He's still holding the pen.
"Just write your name," Ayers says. "I'll remember you as the crasher, and that'll cheer me up."
"Okay,"
Baker says. He writes, "Baker." Then he hands the pen back to Ayers.
"Baker," she reads. "Well, Mr. Baker, it was nice meeting you."
"Baker is my first name," he says.
"Gotcha,"
Ayers says. "You're afraid to write your last name in case I call the police?" Or do you go solely by your first name, like Madonna and Cher?
The latter, he says.
She's flirting with him, he thinks.
He stands up to his full height and squares his shoulders.
Do you want to come outside with me and have a cigarette? She asks. Or are you horrified by a woman who smokes?
He would follow her to East Japip to drink snake venom, he thinks. He answers by scooting the table aside so she could step out. Lead the way, he says.
She navigates around the crowd to the back of the tent where a West Indian man with an orange bandana wrapped around his head is tending to the pig. There's a rubber trash can filled with beer and ice. Ayers grabs two, then says to the man,
You forgot about me, Chester. I'm taking these.
Chester waves his basting brush in the air. Okay, doll. Ayers leads Baker to the edge of the parking lot, where there is a tree with a low branch big and sturdy enough to sit on. Ayers pulls a pack of cigarettes out of a little crocheted purse that hangs across her body and lights up.
I'm horrified by people who smoke, Ayers says. But my best friend just died, and so I'm going to give myself a pass for a while to indulge in some self-destructive behavior.
She hands the cigarette to Baker.
Want to join me?
Sure, he says. He inhales and promptly coughs. Sorry, I'm out of practice. I haven't had a cigarette since I was 14 years old, standing out in back of the ice rink. It's been only weed for me since then.
This makes Ayers laugh. So where are you visiting from, Baker?
Me? He says. Houston.
Houston, Ayers says. Never been. Are you a doctor? You look like a doctor.
No, he nearly says, but my wife's a doctor. I'm not a doctor, he says. I used to trade in commodities, but now I'm kind of between jobs. I do some day trading, and I'm a stay-at-home dad. My son Floyd is 4.
Floyd, Ayers says. Cool name.
It's making a comeback, Baker says. Your name is pretty cool.
My parents are wanderers, Ayers says. They travel all over the world. I was named after Ayers Rock in Australia, which is apparently where I was conceived. But since then, the rock has been reclaimed by the Aboriginals, and now it's called Uluru. And so I am now politically incorrect, Ayers.
It's pretty, Baker says. You're pretty, he thinks.
So what brings you down here? Ayers asks. Vacation?
How should he answer this?
Not a vacation exactly, he says. I'm here with my mom and my brother.
Family reunion? Ayers asks.
I guess you could say that.
Are you married? Ayers asks. She blows out a stream of smoke and looks at him frankly. Something inside of him stirs. Someday, he thinks, he will be married to this girl right here, Ayers Wilson. And they will remember this, their very first conversation, sitting on a low tree branch outside of Chester's getaway during the funeral reception of her best friend, who also happened to be Baker's father's mistress.
I was, he says. I mean, technically I still am. But my wife found a girlfriend. She announced 2 days ago that she was leaving me for her colleague, Louisa.
Ouch, Ayers says.
Don't feel sorry for me, Baker says. It's nothing compared to what you're going through.
That's right, Ayers says. Thanks for reminding me.
I heard your friend was in an accident, Baker says.
He wants to tell her who he is, but he's afraid she'll run off and he'll never see her again.
What was she like?
Rosie? She just was, Ayers says. You know how sometimes people just click, and there's no reason for it? Rosie and I were like that. I met her working at La Tapa.
La Tapa, Baker says.
It's the best restaurant on the island. When I first got to St. John, it was the only place I wanted to work, but places like that can be hard to break into. I was very lucky to get hired, and even luckier that Rosie took me under her wing. Rosie was a local. She's born and raised here. Her parents were born and raised here, and her grandparents. There was no reason for her to befriend me, some white chick who shows up for the season to get in on the good tips, then leaves. But Rosie was nice to me from the very beginning. She was protective. She showed me where the quiet beaches were. She introduced me to a guy who sold me a pickup truck for cheap. She got me the locals discount at Pine Peace Market and introduced me to her mother and her stepfather and just generally treated me like a long-lost sister. Wow, Baker says. He's moved by this, and he wants to ask some strategic follow-up questions. Was she seeing anyone? Had Ayers known Russ? But at that moment, Baker looks up and sees Cash headed toward them, holding two beers in each hand. Baker shakes his head at Cash in an attempt to convey the very important message, "She doesn't know who we are." But Cash looks too hot and pissed off to care about secret codes. "Why the hell did you vanish like that?" Cash asks. "You expected me to find you all the way over here?" "That's my fault," Ayers says, dropping the butt of her cigarette into her now empty beer. "I led your brother astray. Sorry about that." Cash hands Baker two of the four beers and takes a long swallow of one of the beers he's holding. He seems like he's making an effort to regroup. "It's fine," he says. "Cash, this is Ayers Wilson," Baker says. "Ayers is a friend of the deceased."
"Best friend," Ayers interrupts. "Your brother admitted that you two are crashing."
Yeah, Cash says.
"It seems like there would be better ways to spend your precious vacation days than attending a local funeral lunch," Ayers says. "Though Chester's barbecue is pretty good."
"Vacation days?" Cash says,
and he gives Baker a quizzical look.
Ayers takes the awkward moment of silence that follows, during which Baker is silently imploring Cash to just go with it, as an opportunity to stand up.
"I should get back to my post," she says.
"And back to my grief, although God knows that's not going anywhere." She offers Baker her hand.
"Thank you for allowing me to escape for a few minutes. Maybe I'll see you again before you leave."
"I hope so," Baker says. "What's the name of the restaurant where you work?"
"La Tapa," she says. "Right downtown, near Woody's."
"Woody's of the infamous happy hour," Baker says.
Ayers touches a finger to her nose.
"You got it. And hey, go get yourself some barbecue. Anyone gives you trouble, tell them you're with me."
She vanishes back into the crowd.
"What was that?" Cash asks, once she's gone. "You told her we were on vacation?"
But Baker is too love-struck to answer. Irene. She's relieved when the boys leave the villa, because she needs time and space to think, really think, and she needs room to process. There are two weighty issues Irene has to deal with. One is Russ's death, the other is his deception. Because this house, this island, is a very large, very real deception. Russell Steele, Irene's husband of 35 years, is a liar, a schemer, and most likely a cheat. Irene doesn't know what to say. Words fail her, thoughts fail her, and the boys seem to expect both thoughts and words, some expression of pain, some expression of anger. But Irene is so befuddled she can't yet identify pain or anger. Her interior life is a barren wasteland. She thinks back to the woman she was before, even hours before that blood-chilling call from Marilyn Monroe. She had been consumed with her problems at work, the demotion, the magazine moving off in a flashy new direction without her. She had gone to dinner with Lydia. Lydia had said, "You wouldn't understand because you have Russ, who dotes on you night and day." Irene had deflected the statement, saying, "When he's around." But she had thought,
then, that Lydia was right. Irene did have a doting husband, and she didn't properly understand what it was like to be alone. Irene Hagen first met Russell Steele at a bar called the Field House during Irene's senior year in college, when the University of Iowa played Northwestern in a snowstorm, and that snowstorm turned into a blizzard, and I-80, which led back to Chicago, was shut down, effectively stranding all of the Northwestern fans in Iowa City. There had been a rumor circulating among Irene's sorority sisters at Alpha Chi Omega that the Northwestern boys were looking to hook up simply so they would have a place to sleep that night. Only a few minutes after Irene heard this rumor, she felt a tap on her shoulder. "My name is Russell Steele," Russ said. "Would you allow me the honor of buying you a drink?" Irene had scoffed. The guy was cute. Brown hair, brown eyes, hooded Northwestern sweatshirt. Clean cut, her father would have said. And he had a beseeching look on his face. But Irene suffered no fools. "No thanks," she said, and she turned back to her friends. Russell Steele had walked away. The jukebox, Irene remembered, was playing Little Red Corvette, and Irene and her friends had stormed the dance floor. When they returned to their spot at the bar, there was a drink waiting for Irene. At that time in college, she drank something called a lemon drop, because she had an idea that vodka was less fattening than beer. Vanity came at a price. Lemon drops at the Field House cost $5, a relative fortune.
"From that guy, over there," the bartender said. "The enemy."
When Irene looked, Russ waved. He had stayed on the other side of the bar the rest of the night, buying Irene lemon drops, and when it was time to go home, she had gone over to thank him for the drink.
"You didn't have to do that," she said.
"I know," he said, "but you're pretty, and a way better dancer than all your friends."
"You're only saying that because you want a place to sleep tonight."
"I'm saying it because it's true," Russ said. "I'll be fine on a park bench tonight."
Irene had sighed. "You can sleep on the floor of my room," she said. "But I want you out by 9, and if you touch me, I'll call security."
"Deal," Russell Steele said.
Russ had spent the night on Irene's dorm room floor. She had begrudgingly given him one of the blankets and pillows from her own bed, with his arms crossed over his chest, like he was sleeping in a coffin. It had been weird, Irene thought, but also sort of endearing. At 9 a.m. the next morning, when he was on his way out to catch his ride back to Evanston, she gave him her phone number. She had figured she would never hear from him again, but he had called that very night, and the next day, he sent a bouquet of white calla lilies. He had noticed a poster of white callas on Irene's dorm room wall.
"Because you love callas, and because I love you."
That was what the card on the flowers said that had arrived on New Year's Day. Russ had been dead by the time those flowers arrived. Irene thinks back on her marriage. Had she ever had reason to doubt Russ's honesty or his fidelity? No. Russ's dominant trait had been one of utter devotion. He had never been one to flirt with other women. If Irene complimented a certain woman's figure or sense of style, Russ would say, "I didn't notice." And Irene believed him. There was a way in which their marriage had been divided in half. The first half of their marriage, they had been normal, hardworking Midwesterners, trying to raise two boys. Russ had his job selling corn syrup, and Irene was a full-time mother who picked up freelance editing work once the boys were in school. They lived in a nondescript ranch house on Clover Street, a cul-de-sac east of the university, close to the high school. Irene won't lie. Those had been lean years. She might even characterize them as tough. If Irene and Russ wanted to do anything fun or special, even a night out to dinner at the steakhouse in the Amanas, they had to budget. When Irene's minivan died, they'd had to ask Russ's mother, Millie, for a loan. When Russ got the job offer from Todd Croft, it had seemed nothing short of a miracle, or like God's benevolent intervention finally lifting them up. Suddenly, there was money. So much money. They were able to send Baker to Northwestern without taking out any loans. Then they were able to buy the fixer-upper of Irene's dreams on Church Street. A scant year after Russ got this new job, Irene was offered a full-time editorial position at Heartland Home and Style. Between the renovation and the new job, Irene had been so consumed, so busy, that she had barely taken notice of the dark side of their good fortune. Russ became less like a man she was married to and more like a man she dated whenever he was in town. But she had liked that, hadn't she? It had been nice to have Russ out from underfoot, to have freedom and autonomy when it came to making decisions about the new house, which was especially sweet since she no longer worried about their finances. Irene had been complicit in the change to their relationship. She had preferred their new situation to the slog of everyday married life. Irene's friends and co-workers asked why Irene never joined Russ on his business trips. He was in Florida, right? Didn't Irene want to enjoy the sun? Irene used to answer, "I'll join him one of these days. I just need to find the time." Deep down, Irene knew she should have been asking Russ questions. How did he like the new job? What were its downsides, its challenges? She should have kept track of where he was on certain days, who his clients were. She should have made plans to travel with him. But she didn't. And that's really all she can say. She didn't. And so, as much as Irene wants to believe that Russ was an evil, deceptive charlatan with unfathomable secrets, she understands that she is partly to blame. She is disturbed that Todd Croft made the unilateral decision to cremate Russ's body. He should have asked her permission. He should have given Irene control. Baker spoke to someone at Border Control and discovered that because the crash happened in British waters, the British authorities, Virgin Islands Search and Rescue, VISAR, in conjunction with Her Majesty's Coast Guard, HMCG, needs to give the FAA the authority to investigate the cause of the crash. But there are loopholes and regulations, like with any bureaucracy. "I can't tell if they're giving me the runaround or if it's just a lot of red tape," Baker says. "I haven't talked to the same person twice, so I don't have an ally. I did find out that the pilot's name is Stephen Thompson and he was a British citizen. The helicopter apparently belonged to him. So it's a British helicopter with a British pilot that crashed into British waters." They are, essentially, being held hostage here as they wait for the ashes and the findings from the crash site investigation. The only upside is this gives Irene time to do some detective work. She sits down at the desk in Russ's study. There is nothing in any of the drawers but pens and some paper clips. Nothing on the shelves but one lonely legal pad. Someone came in and removed everything else. The phone on Russ's desk works, and so, once the boys have left, Irene dials the 305 number that Marilyn Monroe called from on Tuesday night. Area code 305, she now knows, is Miami. This at least makes a certain kind of sense. The phone rings three times, and Irene's stomach clenches. She will demand to talk to Todd Croft. She deserves answers. She deserves answers. What kind of business was Russ involved in? What was going on down here? She fears Todd won't tell her. The phone clicks over to a recording, telling her that the number she has dialed is no longer in service. No longer in service. Somehow, Irene isn't surprised. She tries Paulette's cell phone next, but is shuttled right to voicemail. There's a magnet on the refrigerator from the real estate company, which provides a phone number. A woman answers on the first ring.
Afternoon, this is Welcome to Paradise Real Estate, Octavia speaking. How can I help you?
Yes, hello, Irene says. May I please speak to Paulette Vickers?
Paulette is out of the office today, I'm afraid, Octavia says. Would you like her voicemail?
It's urgent, Irene says. Is there any way I might speak to her in person?
I'm afraid not, Octavia says. She's at a funeral. I don't expect her back in the office until tomorrow morning.
Funeral? Irene thinks.
Okay, Octavia. Thank you very much, Irene says. And she hangs up.
Funeral for the local woman, Irene thinks. The local woman who was in the helicopter with Russ and the British pilot, Stephen Thompson, flying at 7 o'clock in the morning from St. John to an island in the British Virgin Islands called Anagata. Who was this local woman?
Irene isn't naive. There is no possibility that Russ lived in this house by himself, without a companion, without a woman. Irene thinks back to the day before when Cash was searching the master bedroom. He told Irene he'd found nothing, but Irene knew he was lying. Winnie comes banging into the study, panting and wagging her tail, sniffing at Irene's knees. Irene rubs Winnie's soft butterscotch head and says, "Come with me." She and Winnie enter the master bedroom, and Irene says, "What are we looking for, Winnie? What are we looking for?" She stands in the middle of the room and inhales, trying to divine something, anything, using her intuition. Someone came through the house and cleared it out, sweeping away all of Russ's dirt. But something, Cash found something. He had that expression on his face, feigned innocence, like when he used to hide his one hitter in his varsity soccer jacket. And years before that, when he finished an entire box of Girl Scout cookies, Caramel Delights, by himself, and then stuffed the box deep in the trash. Stuffed the box deep in the trash. Irene looks around the room for hidden nooks and crannies. She checks the drawer of the nightstand. Empty. She sees Winnie nosing the bed. Is she picking up a scent? Winnie seems pretty interested, nearly insistent, her nose working into the gap between the mattress and the box spring. "What are you doing?" Irene asks. She lifts the white matelassé coverlet. She has to admit there is a freshness to the decor of this house that is a nice alternative to the heavy, dark furnishings of home, and slips her hand under the mattress. Bingo. She feels the edge of something. She pulls out a frame, a photograph. Oh. Oh, no. God, no. Irene sits on the bed, her hands shaking. The photograph is of Russ with a beautiful young West Indian woman. They're lying in a hammock, their limbs intertwined. The woman's skin is the color of coffee with cream, and next to her, Russ is golden, glowing. He looks healthy. He looks happy. Irene lets out a moan. She can't believe the agony she feels. Russ had another woman, a lover. More than a lover. Irene can tell from the ease and familiarity of their pose, from Russ's smile, from the woman's eyes shining. They were together, a pair, a couple. They were in love. Irene wants to smash the glass. She wants to go out onto the balcony and throw the offending photograph as far as she can into the tropical bush below. But she needs it. It's evidence. Irene is mortified to think that Cash has seen this photo, this proof of his father's secret life. It conveys failure, on Russ's part, certainly, but also on Irene's part. She wasn't sexy, desirable, or enticing enough to have kept her husband happy at home. This photograph is proof. Irene screams until she feels her voice reach its ragged edge. It feels so indulgent,
so childish, but it's also the release she's been waiting for. Russ was cheating on her, living with someone young and beautiful, having sex with her, laughing with her, kissing her, eating meals with her, curling up in a hammock with her, falling asleep next to her. For how long? For years, Irene has to assume. Every single time he told her he was working in Florida or God knows where else, he was here in this house with this woman. The depth of Russ's lies takes Irene's breath away. Hundreds of lies, thousands of lies. He had professed his love for Irene daily, every single time she spoke to him on the phone. He had told her he loved her so often, she had stopped hearing it. She thinks of the airplane he hired to drag a banner around Iowa City on her 50th birthday. At the time, Irene had been embarrassed by that blatant show of devotion. What she hadn't realized, of course, was that Russ was trying to compensate. He hadn't hired the airplane banner because he loved Irene and wanted everyone to know it. He'd hired it because he felt guilty. And did this woman know? Irene wonders. Did she know that Russ was married and had two sons? Did she know he lived in a Victorian house in Iowa City, Iowa? Had Russ shown her pictures of Irene? It's too heinous to contemplate. Irene cries, she wails, and Winnie starts to bark, but Irene can't stop. She's grateful that the boys are gone so she can just let go. She was such a trusting fool. She thinks back on the many hours that she spent comforting Lydia. When Lydia found out that her husband Phil, philandering Phil, was cheating on her. Phil worked as the head of security for the University of Iowa. One night, he answered a call from a freshman named Natalie Mercer, who was receiving calls on her dorm room phone. The caller kept saying he was watching her. He could see what she was wearing. He was coming to get her when she least expected it. Irene could remember Lydia relaying these terrifying details to her back when Natalie Mercer was a faceless university student. Phil ended up catching the guy, a doctoral candidate in psychology of all things. He was expelled from the school and this was, in theory, a happy ending. Peace was restored. Phil was a hero. But then, over a year later, when Lydia sensed the temperature of her marriage cooling to a suspicious low, she did some snooping. And what did she find? Phil's cell phone documenting a lurid affair with Natalie Mercer that dated all the way back to the day Phil caught the caller. Irene remembers feeling disgusted with Phil, but also, in her most private thoughts, a bit incredulous that Phil had been conducting an affair for over a year and Lydia hadn't noticed. Compared to what Russ has done, Phil having an affair with a student seems almost quaint. Irene and Russ were married at the First Presbyterian Church in Iowa City in 1984 when they were fresh out of college. They had been together for a scant year and a half since that football game in the blizzard. Russ's father, the Navy pilot, was dead by then, but Millie was there to represent. Millie and Irene had hit it off from the moment they met. Because Russ had grown up in so many places, he didn't have any longtime childhood friends or neighbors or members of the community attending the wedding the way that Irene did. He had Millie and Millie's two sisters, Bobby and Sissy, whom Russ called the aunties, and there were also a bunch of Russ's friends and fraternity brothers from Northwestern. Nothing about Russ's background had seemed unusual, and certainly not sinister. Irene and Russ had said their vows and kissed on the altar. There had been a reception at the Elks Lodge, where they ate filet mignon and cut the cake and danced to Little Red Corvette, and then after the reception, Irene and Russ ran through a shower of rice to get to the getaway car. They drove to the Hancock House, a bed and breakfast in Dubuque, Iowa, where they were given a suite with a library and a clawfoot tub in front of a fireplace in the bathroom, and it was in this moment that Irene fell in love with the style and decor of Queen Anne houses. She said to Russ, "I want us to live in a house just like this one." Russ had laughed nervously. They were dirt poor, renting a one-bedroom apartment in University City. They were kids. They had, Irene sees now, barely known each other then, the newly minted Mr. and Mrs. Russell Steele. Irene had grown to know Russ the only way it could be done, by putting in the time. Irene had learned how Russ liked his coffee, how he liked his eggs, the way he brushed his teeth, the sound of his snoring, the habits of other drivers that made him angry, the actors he admired and found funny, the way he whistled Penny Lane, only that song, when he was doing small home improvement projects. Irene knew his shoe size, his jacket size, his waist and inseam. She knew how he had voted in every election. She knew his first, second, and third favorite flavor of ice cream. She knew he would get 40 pages into a book, then abandon it, no matter how good it was. She knew that he had spent his childhood as a constant outsider because he moved so often. She also knew he never felt like his father loved him. Russ's father was a military man, a fortress, with a mind and heart that were impossible to penetrate. Irene knew that, because of his father, Russ had never wanted to serve in the military. In fact, if Irene were to disclose Russ's biggest secret, it was that he had sabotaged his chances of getting into the U.S. Naval Academy by intentionally missing his interview. That, as it turns out, was not his biggest secret. Irene howls. There are so many thoughts that pierce her, not least of which is her own blindness, her own myopia, her own pathetic, middle-class, middle-America view that marriages are meant to last forever, through the bad times, through the boring times. They were Russ and Irene Steele, parents of Baker and Cash, owner of the stunning Victorian on Church Street. They are good, God-fearing, straightforward people. Not people with scandalous secrets. Finally, Irene stops crying. She wears herself out. She must have worn Winnie out as well, because Winnie has fallen asleep in a sunny spot on the floor. Irene regards the photograph. Russ has a lover, an island girl. It seems less awful than it did 40 minutes earlier. One thing Irene has learned in her 57 years is that no matter how hideous something seems at first, with the passing of time comes acclimatization and then acceptance. What Irene is living through now is abhorrent. But the world is filled with deceptions and betrayals. Nearly every life has one. And yet the sun still rises and sets. The world continues on. Irene sits up. The water out the window seems to wink at her, and not in a wicked, "I seduced your husband" sort of way, but in a benevolent way. What did Paulette say? 80 steps down to a private beach. Okay. Irene decides to go barefoot. The stone steps turn to wood. They meander down the side of the hill until the vegetation clears, and Irene steps onto a tiny, perfect crescent of white sand beach. The sand is like sugar, like flour, like talcum. She stoops to pick some up and rub it between her fingers. Is it real? Yes. There are 3 teak chaises on the beach with bright orange cushions. Irene tries to imagine Russ lying on one of these chaises, with his girlfriend next to him. And who would the 3rd chaise be for, she wonders. Today, it's for Irene. She lies back in the sun, absorbing the heat, which feels like a miracle after the icy winds of Iowa City. She can't stay here long, just another minute. Wrinkles are multiplying on her face by the second, she's certain. Her breathing is almost back to normal. Her eyes are sore but dry. Russ had a lover. Deep breath. Okay. Irene gets up and walks to the water's edge. The color is halfway between blue and green. It's not a color found elsewhere in nature, except, in rare and wonderful cases, people's eyes. Tiny waves lap at her feet. The water is soft and just cool enough to be refreshing. Irene wishes she had brought a bathing suit, but when she'd packed back in Iowa, she couldn't imagine circumstances in which she would want or need one. She looks both ways. This beach is secluded from view. There are a few boats on the horizon, but no one can see her here. Irene shucks off her clothes and stands naked on the beach. Is she invisible? She feels quite the opposite. She feels exposed. Let the world see her drooping breasts, the dimpling at her thighs, the cesarean scar 8 inches across her lower abdomen. She steps into the water, and all she could think is how good it feels, the coolness enveloping her. She swims out a few yards. This is the same water that claimed Russ. Russ is dead. That's the next fact Irene has to grapple with. He's gone. He's never coming back. She will never see him again. She can't ask him why he did what he did, where she went wrong, where they both went wrong. She can't scream at him, and he can't apologize. There is nowhere to put her fury, no one to answer the question of why. Irene lies back in the water, floating, looking at the cloudless bluebird sky and thinks, really thinks, what it was like for Russ in that helicopter. Irene has never been in a helicopter, but she has a vague notion that it's loud. Russ was probably wearing a headset. Did he see the storm approaching? Did he see flashes of lightning or hear thunder? Was he scared? When the helicopter got hit, did it go into a free fall? Was it terrifying? Did Russ have a second or two when he knew they were plummeting, when the earth was getting closer and closer? Did his heart stop? Did he have any thoughts? Did he think about Irene and the boys? And what about impact? Did he burst into flames? Did he lose consciousness? Did he drown? Irene sets her feet on the firm sandy bottom, then wades toward shore until her toe hits something solid. She bends down and picks up a smooth gray rock the size of an egg. She drops the stone from hip height into the water and watches it sink. Russ's body had been lying at the bottom of the sea like that rock. Irene's heart shatters. The tears she cries now aren't of anger or indignation, but of pure sadness. Russ is dead, and the woman, his lover, his love, is dead. Dead. Never coming back. I will forgive them, Irene thinks. I will make myself forgive them if it's the last thing I do. Irene dries off in the sun, puts her clothes back on, and faces the 80 steps she has to climb to get back to the villa. The woman in the photograph is young, 30 or 35. She must have family, parents, and Irene is going to find out who they are.